Imagine being a wide-eyed college student eager for a chance and landing a dream gig in the traveling orchestra led by a well-known American conductor. It may seem too good to be true, but for our next guest, it was true, except for the really, really fake part. Jessica, I want you to set the scene for as you open the new memoir, Sounds Like Titanic, with a note that reads in part, "This is a memoir about working as a fake violinist for a famous American composer." And you only refer to that person as the composer. And you say the memoir is about being a fake, but that the memoir itself is not fake. Explain that.
Yes. So the book itself is about the years I spent as a violinist for an ensemble that is well-known in America. And the way this would work is that I would play in front of a dead microphone while a CD recording of a better, more talented violinist was blasted out toward unsuspecting audiences. And this happened at craft fairs around America, shopping malls, but also some of our nation's finest concert halls as well. So while I was involved in this fake performance, the book about the fake performance is true. I have worked incredibly hard to be as truthful to my memory and to do research to ensure that everything that I wrote in the book is true.
It's a fascinating story of deception. And I want to dive into different parts of the book as we proceed here. But first, you were a novice violinist. You had some aspirations. You had a growing interest in that instrument. What were your ultimate hopes and dreams as a musician leading up to this?
Well, you know, my first interest in the violin came when I was 4 years old. I was growing up in West Virginia, and I happened to see this cartoon called Sarah and the Squirrel, and there was violin music. And it turned out that music, I found out later in my 20s, was Vivaldi's Winter. But at the time, I just knew I loved this music, and I begged my parents for years until I was eight, every Christmas, every birthday, for a violin. But we lived in this remote part of West Virginia where there were no violin teachers. Finally, after years of begging, they agreed to drive me to Virginia for lessons. So I studied the violin for about 13 years, went off to college hoping to be a music major, but found out pretty soon that I was not going to cut it. There were dozens of better violinists than me just on my dormitory floor alone in college. So I was barely going to make the college orchestra. At that point, I kind of put that dream aside. A few years later in college, you know, I was really struggling for tuition money. And at that point, I came across this very strange ad at the college listserv that said, "We're seeking violinists to play with this ensemble that has performed with PBS and NPR." And I was like, this is so strange. You know, professional orchestras don't usually advertise on college listservs. But it had always been my dream to get paid to play the violin, like it is for many people who love playing an instrument. And I thought, why not? Why not just send a demo tape and see what happens? And about 3 days later, I was hired without an audition and without really even an interview. And it took my first 8 to 12 hours of playing the first day of my gig to even realize that the microphones in front of the musicians were not quite on. It was a really interesting optical and aural illusion that was going on.
And we're going to talk about that. So you were at college at Columbia in New York City. So expensive.
Yes.
And you needed to pay your bills. And you saw this opportunity as a way to get some extra cash and to cover that very expensive tuition and the very expensive lifestyle of living in the Big Apple. So even though you ended up part of what we later learn was a sham ensemble, in a way, you got to live out this violinist dream, right? I mean, you went on a 54-city tour of the United States. You went to China. You played on national television. You played at Carnegie Hall. And you paid your college tuition and rent in New York City, which is not cheap doing this. So tell us about that point where you became aware that this wasn't honest.
It came kind of in stages. So within the first day of working, my first gig with this ensemble was actually a small craft fair in New Hampshire. And it was my training weekend, so I was actually watching other musicians do this. And it took me a while of listening for, you know, hours before I realized, wait a second, you know, I'm not really hearing much of the music that they're actually producing with their instruments. And then I ended up doing a few songs of my own and realized I was messing up left and right. I was just getting notes wrong. And none of the audience members could tell. They were applauding. They were just looking at me like I was, you know, the best violinist in the world. And I realized that they couldn't hear anything that I was actually producing with my instrument. So I realized at that point that, oh, well, the reason I've been hired, despite not having many skills, is that there's a CD playing of someone else, and that's what people are hearing. I was 21 at that time and just so grateful to have a job that I was like, and you know, it didn't seem to be harming anyone. This is not illegal. The audience seemed very happy to purchase CDs that we were selling. And people love the music. So I didn't really see it as being, you know, something particularly harmful or nefarious. It was just a strange job. As I went on through the 4 years and, you know, went on tour, this started to really, you know, kind of the contrast between the standing ovations and the great praise that people would give me, and then the reality of knowing that, like, this was, you know, not real, started to really weigh on me. Not so much in terms of, like, guilt, you know, because, again, the audience members loved it. They were happy. The music made them happy. But more just making me worried about what I was doing with my life, right, in terms of a career, and wanting to have a more authentic way of spending my time and using my brain, so...
Early in this story, you make an observation that you were raised upper class in Appalachia. You mentioned you were raised in West Virginia, and you were raised upper class enough in West Virginia that you believed you could make music for a living, but you were also lower class enough not to know how to do that. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so one of the contradictions this book really gets into is class and how it works in terms of when an Ivy League school admits someone from Appalachia, what actually happened, you know, why are they doing that? What actually happens to that person? I mean, this is something that has obviously been discussed a lot recently with things like other memoirs like Hillbilly Elegy, right? Totally different kind of take on this. But in terms of, you know, where this book is coming from, I found myself, you know, coming from a town in which I had so much privilege comparatively to other people who I grew up with, to going to the Ivy League where I was seen as poor, where people would literally give me their clothes and felt extremely bad for me that I didn't have enough money for tuition and couldn't really understand that. It was just not even like, hadn't even like occurred to many of my classmates and professors that that could even be a possibility that you wouldn't have enough money to go to college. And so the contradictions of that, of being privileged in one world and seen as not privileged in another, is another kind of big theme of this book.
Do you think that's an experience that may be common in different parts of the country?
Yes. I think this is something that we get into, probably increasing with increasing wealth inequality. And the ways in which elite institutions try to legitimize themselves by saying, oh, look, but we've let someone in from West Virginia, right? So we can't be too elitist, right? Look, we have our person here, but like without making any sort of accommodations for your acclimatization into that culture, right? I was completely lost a lot of times in New York City and at Columbia specifically.
And now you're in Highland Heights. You're a professor at Northern Kentucky University, where you teach creative writing and where you received the Outstanding Junior Faculty Award. Do you see similarities at that institution, my alma mater, where students may have some talent in one creative field or another, but no idea what to do with it?
I do. And that's why I love working at NKU. I love my students. I often tell people they're the perfect students for the sort of professor that I want to be. And and it's really an honor to teach them. And yes, I see students there who have extremely great talents and great potential. And I see them also, you know, kind of similar to my story, not having any idea of how to actually, you know, what are the next steps to achieving that. And so that is a big part of my role there in the creative writing department, is to help each student get to the next step of where their potential can take them.
Jessica Chiquetto-Heinemann is the author of Sounds Like Titanic, a new memoir about her time as a violinist in a sham ensemble. She's our guest today on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm your host, Michael Monks. One critic who reviewed your book suggested that the story would be unbelievable as a novel, but as a memoir, it is deliciously bizarre and utterly American. So tell me about your feelings about the response that the book has gotten so far. Has that been an enjoyable experience for you?
Yeah, I think for anyone, this is my debut, right, my first book, and it is quite a process of going from years and years of writing, which is a solitary activity, and then maybe getting some feedback in workshops or from your professors, And then going to suddenly this is out nationwide and people, strangers from all over the country are responding. And so far the response has been amazingly positive, and that is great. But you really just don't know. And that's something I try to talk about with my students too, is that you can do your best to create your best art. At the end of the day, you have no control over the reader's responses to your work.
So you're a professor, of course. So you're giving feedback to these young, aspiring creative writers. Uh-huh. And now you're in this position where you're getting some feedback at a different level. So what are your thoughts in general on criticism of literature now that you have this book out and with your role at the university? Do you read the reviews? Are you excited for them? Do you encourage that?
Yeah. Well, just in terms of my general philosophy, I think when it comes to feedback of any kind, it is just as important to give positive, you know, criticism as then to go into what could be different. When you're talking about a finished product like a book, it's hard. You know, again, this is my first time, so I may change my mind at any time about this, but I actually do enjoy reading what people have, you know, responded, you know, online or, you know, anywhere else. Just in terms of, it's fascinating, and I hope it helps me in terms of writing my next project, whatever that is, in terms of like thinking about my audience, right? Who's out there, who's interested in reading memoir?
Well, let's get back to that story. Mm-hmm. I want you to read a brief passage from the book. It sets the stage for the fraud. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to that part.
This is from the opening part of the tour. It's the chapter is called God Bless America Tour 2004, Philadelphia. Act 1, What is Unseen? The composer runs laps around the PBS station parking lot. He wears his concert clothes, black pants, blue dress shirt, and his running shoes. Harriet, Stephen, and I watch him from inside the RV where we change into our concert clothes while dancing to Outkast. When he finishes his run, the composer asks us to come outside where Patrick is unloading the sound equipment for our first concert on the God Bless America tour. Patrick is a retired union contract negotiator who loves the composer's music so much that he has negotiated himself into a contract to drive the composer's ensemble around America for no money. He has never driven an RV before, but he seems content in his role so long as he can listen to the composer's music while driving. Harriet, Stephen, and I file out of the air-conditioned RV onto the sticky asphalt. Stephen, a flutist, wears an all-black suit and tie. A tall, thin, bespectacled man in his mid-30s, Stephen has one of those kind, encouraging faces that induces calm in others. Harriet and I wear long black dresses with stockings and heels. Harriet is in her early 30s but looks much younger. She has short black hair that emphasizes her high cheekbones and big brown eyes. She's tall and beautiful in a flawless, preppy way, like a J. Crew model, and also plays violin. I stand beside her, a much shorter, 23-year-old woman, my rhinestone concert barrettes restraining waves of long, thick, unruly black hair. "Hey, you guys, could you give me a hand?" the composer asks. The composer refers to us as "you guys" because despite the fact that I have worked for him for over 2 years, despite the fact that he is supposed to announce my name at every concert on the God Bless America tour for the next 3 months, he still does not know that my name is Jessica. When he needs my attention, he calls me Melissa. His request for manual labor floats thick on the hot August air, blending with the noxious fumes from the RV's exhaust pipe and the faint scent of ruined birthday cake. I look at Harriet, who looks at Stephen. Without saying anything, we understand. The composer can replace us with musicians who are even more desperate for work than we are. New immigrants from Russia, Hungary, Romania, China. The world is full of starving musicians. Harriet picks up a heavy, dusty bag full of extension cords. Stephen helps Patrick lift a film projector, and the composer deadlifts an amplifier. I lug a cardboard box full of the composer's CDs and stumble under the weight of it, teetering in my concert heels. We make several trips back and forth from the RV to the concert room. By the time we are finished, our concert clothes are smeared with sweat and sawdust. My feet are bleeding from lifting boxes and high-heeled shoes, but my concert dress is long enough to hide the damage. Act 2, What is Unheard? The composer enters stage left, bouncing towards his electric piano with a childlike exuberance, waving and beaming at the cheering audience. Two violinists and a flutist follow him onto the stage. He sits down at his piano while his musicians stand behind three microphones. Without pausing to tune, they lift their instruments and begin. two film projection screens on either side of the stage light up with images of an eagle swooping over the Grand Canyon. The audience hears the soaring sound of a penny whistle, a recorder-like flute that produces the high-pitched wail made famous by Celine Dion's ballad, My Heart Will Go On, from the film Titanic. The audience also hears the sounds of the violins and piano. But no one, except the three musicians, can see the composer press the play button on a portable Sony CD player he bought that morning at a Walmart for $14.95. Act 3, What is Unnoticed? Halfway through the concert, the composer introduces us to the crowd. He says, "The woman here with the biggest, most beautiful smile is Harriet. Doesn't she have the biggest smile? Give her a hand." Then he gestures to me and says, "This is, Melissa." "Melissa on the violin, everybody. Isn't she great? Give her a hand."
But of course, you're not Melissa. You are Jessica Cicchetto Heinemann, and this is your new book, Sounds Like Titanic. Now, again, this guy you refer to, the composer, you don't identify his name in the book, but you do drop plenty of hints. It's a man. He sold millions of albums, you write. He has Hollywood celebrities narrate his PBS specials, raising millions of dollars for public television. He appears live on the QVC shopping channel, where he sells thousands of CDs an hour, you said. Why did you decide to take that approach rather than to identify the composer directly?
Yeah, at a certain part of the process, I realized that this was a story that was much bigger than this individual person, and it's much bigger than me. What I was really trying to get at here was the ways in which authenticity was really starting to be questioned in our culture, particularly in the years after 9/11. Those were the years in which suddenly reality television became a term that people used. We had the lead up to the Iraq War under false pretenses. And a lot of the sort of things that we question today in terms of what is fake, what is real, I think they find themselves kind of coming to fruition at that time, the years 2001 to about 2006. So after a lot of thought, I realized that, you know, I did not want to name him because it's not really the point to say who he is. And the other thing is that as I continued writing, I started to feel a real kinship with him in terms of his art and then the art of trying to tell a real true story. You know, I am genuinely trying my very best to tell the truth, and yet the truth is often hard to capture exactly, right, on the page. Other people may have other recollections of things that have happened. This is something that we talk about in memoir writing class all the time, of like, how do we tell the most truthful portrait? And so his pseudonym in the book, The Composer, actually also kind of refers to me as well, the composer of the book, because by the end of this book, I was like, you know, as much as, you know, I don't particularly admire his music or his style of playing, I do find some things in common with him in terms of his ambition to want to succeed, his hard work. These are things we had in common.
It's interesting that he had a hard time learning what your name was, and now you're writing a book about it and not using his name.
Right.
Does he know about this book?
I don't know, and I just don't know.
Okay. Yeah. What about the rest of the people that you worked with? You do talk about some of the people that you shared this experience with. How did they feel about the situation?
Yeah. I had the pleasure of one of the main characters of the book reading it this past summer. And to my great relief, he loved it and said, "This is exactly how I remember things." And so that was wonderful to kind of have that affirmation. So that's been my main view. And he's the character known as Yevgeny in the book. And so having his, you know, enthusiastic thumbs up for the book was some of the best feedback I got.
You write, of course, about the realization that this is a, to put it mildly, I guess, a fraudulent presentation and all of these events that you're participating in. So I'm hoping you'll read another section that comes from that part of the book so that we get an understanding of your realization of the deception.
Sure. "Years later, you will recognize the same desperation in other young people, especially young women, and you will know. You were desperate for the respect the customers gave to you as a professional violinist, respect that you had never experienced in previous jobs as a waitress, receptionist, or assistant. In those positions, you acted flirtatious yet docile. You endured condescension and even harassment by imagining the work was temporary, though it never quite felt that way. The pose felt intertwined with a more permanent position, female. But playing the violin for money had no such associations. What you felt that day in New Hampshire was freedom. You wanted it so badly, you didn't dare question whether or not it was real.
And do you now question whether or not it was real? Or do you know that it was?
Yeah, I mean, I think that feeling of wanting a job in which you are respected for what you do, that is real. I think that's something that a lot of people feel. And I think there are a lot of people out there who go into various lines of work who find themselves being like, is this really the real job? Like, this can't be it. Is this, you know, there's that famous line in The Wire where the newspaper reporter is keeping like, one day I'll work at a real newspaper. I think a lot of us feel that way of like, one day I'll work at a real such and such. And I think that feeling itself is real, that like somehow, you know, we're looking for authentic work and sometimes our jobs come up short at making us feel that way. I now have a job where I actually feel what I do is real, and I really appreciate that because at this point in my life when I was 21 and first starting with this, I'd never had a job in which people saw me, I think, as a complete human being and not kind of like, you know, a service employee who was like at their beck and call, you know, someone who's like invisible in a lot of ways. And so I think that's something a lot of people can identify with, that feeling of invisibility at work, the feeling that no one is respecting you, feeling that what you're doing isn't quite real or it doesn't matter.
Events of the book took place about 15 and more years ago. Mm-hmm. Did you reflect on this period throughout those 15 years leading up to the release of this book?
Oh, yeah. I started, the first notes of this book I was writing on tour, and I started writing would become one chapter in this book back in the fall of 2005. So now I took various breaks to, you know, basically I was working a lot during those years, but I was always writing this book. So all told, it took me about 13 years from first drafts of chapters to, pitching, selling, editing the book with Norton.
So looking back on the events of the book, how do you feel differently about them now than while you were experiencing them in real time?
You know, I get into that at the very end. I mean, the book did take so long to write that I had the ability to really have some perspective on these events by the end. And I think one of the things I just really felt differently about is that the composer and I had those things in common, and that this, again, wasn't so much an expose of this particular man doing this particular performance or this particular ensemble. It was about a time in our history in which all sorts of things started to become fake. And, you know, this is not the only job I talk about in the book. I talk about working in reality TV at MTV during the same time period for a show called True Life, which ended up not being quite True Life. I talk about a job that advertised itself as being for the New York Times, but it was not the New York Times. So I think, you know, we're living in an age where it's increasingly hard to know, you know, what your job actually entails and how much of it is real work, how much of it is some sort of fakery.
You've got your first book down. What are you working on now?
I am working on another project. I am one of those writers who is terrified of saying what that is for fear of it slipping through my fingers the minute I try to articulate it. But I'm working on another first-person narrative.
Very cool. We'll look forward to that. If you want to know the rest of what happens and sounds like Titanic, you got to go buy it. It's written by Jessica Chiquetto Heinemann, and she's been our guest today on Cincinnati Edition. Thanks for coming out and talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. For more than a decade, the 10th leading cause of death for all Americans is suicide. The stats are even worse for younger people. What's causing the slow rise in people dying by suicide? We take a look at the symptoms and discuss local efforts to increase suicide prevention. Tomorrow at noon on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.